Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest this week is the renowned writer on faith and religion, Barbara Brown Taylor. I've read and been influenced by many of Barbara's books, and so I was excited when she agreed to be on this podcast. We focused our conversation on two of her books, her latest, Holy Envy, Finding God in the Faith of Others, and the book she wrote in 2006, Leaving Church, A Memoir of Faith. She shared insights into her teaching and writing career, failure and resilience, and also answered the question, if you could give a TED Talk about anything other than religion and faith, what would it be? I hope you enjoy it. Barbara Brown Taylor, thank you so much for being on the Failing Boldly podcast.
I'm happy to be here. I have a lot of experience with this, so I'm looking forward to the conversation.
As I was finishing Holy Envy, I had a sense of what my first question would be, and then you pretty much summarized it in the epilogue of your book. You wrote, there's no such thing as religion. There are only religious people who embody the scripts of their faiths as differently as dancers embody the steps of their dances. And so the category in the back of the book is religion and spirituality. And so a person might think when they read the book, I'm only going to be reading about God, but really this is a book as much about humanity, isn't it?
It is. And I'm an old person now, so I've gone through a lot of stages in the ways I read religion and church and scripture. But I do think it is more revelatory of us, you know, of the human beings than it perhaps is of the one who is beyond our knowing and yet to whom we can't, you know, quit reaching, for whom we can't quit reaching.
Especially the stranger. That seems to be a pretty common theme in the book, too, and how we interrelate and engage the stranger.
I really did decide halfway through. Since you've read the book, you know that you kind of wait till the end to see where I'm going to land. And I did decide what I love most about my religion is that it teaches me that if my religion comes between me and my neighbor, I should choose the neighbor. Mm-hmm. And my religion taught me that. So I love it. And stranger is, I think, a more challenging way to put the same teaching, because certainly it comes up stranger more often in the First Testament, and neighbor we're a little more comfortable with, but I think that includes stranger.
It seems that when I think about when people are thinking about engaging a different religion, I'm sure there are lots of different ways that people might do it. Two that come to mind for me, and it seems like it comes out a little bit in the book, is one way is that a person, especially if they grew up Christian, might have been taught to not engage a different religion at all, that might be damaging to their own faith. Mm-hmm. And then another person who at least is interested, but they might be nervous or not engaged because they're afraid that they're going to do it wrong or that they'll offend somebody. And so I'm wondering if those two were different perspectives, particularly from your students, and then are there other ways that people, when they first think about engaging a different religion, you know, what is their thought process?
You know, you just made a light bulb come on for me, because you said when people think about engaging another religion, right? So we're back to religion as some artifact, as a thing. And certainly that's where alarms go off. Oh, I'm about to explore Buddhism or Islam or Judaism. But if you go on a field trip with me, you're not going to encounter a religion. You're going to encounter people, you know, people who are walking around their own sacred spaces and pulling out chairs for you and offering you tea or cookies. And that's a real different thing from engaging a religion. Mm-hmm. So I would tag that first of all, that it's become hugely important to me to think of the dancers of these faiths and not the faiths themselves as dance steps on the wall. Mm. It really does come down to how it's embodied. And it can be embodied horribly. I mean, there are a couple of field trips with students that went so badly wrong that afterwards I'd have to say, you know, go again some other place, some other time on your own. So there's no guarantee you get a perfect stranger at the other end. But I certainly encountered both things you're talking about. Students who had been taught very strictly that to even acknowledge any goodness in another tradition would bring judgment down on them, which is why I named the book Holy Envy. Mm-hmm. You know, and then others who'd always been curious but had never been given a chance to explore at all. So I think that's why the course stayed full for so long.
And once students just begin to meet these religious people and engage with them and have conversations and have cookies with them and tea. Is that, do you find often where holy envy really comes into play as opposed to reading about it, but it really engaging it? Seems to, that's where the envy comes from, or begins to anyway.
Yes. And over 20 years with a lot of different students, I couldn't put my finger on anything that stayed constant for more than a couple of years at a time. It's why the course kept changing. But I did find the personal encounter, and especially the awkwardness of personal encounter, because you mentioned that as well, to be the guest, not the host, you know, not the student in a classroom whose teacher has invited someone to find room 218 in Daniel Hall, but, you know, for us to be the guests and not to know exactly how to behave, put a beautiful edge on the encounters, you know, so that we were more prepped to receive hospitality and to recognize the kindness of people who are doing this on their own time. I mean, guest docents here and there, and, you know, rarely clergy people, you know, usually members of these different faith communities who hosted us. So yeah, I did find it essential to get out of the classroom. Though left alone, I could, you know, create all kinds of perfect scenarios of other traditions. And students were attracted, above all, like the Four Noble Truths from Buddhism, mm-hmm. they could get a hold of that. And when they learned the Five Pillars of Islam, I mean, those kinds of things, even on a textbook page, were intriguing to them. Mm-hmm. You know, when they compare them with central teachings or disciplines of their own Christian varieties of faith, because there was as much variety of Christianity in the classroom as there was variety of religions in the textbook.
Yeah. Did you find in your years of teaching that more and more you were finding the what people are calling the spiritual but not religious student, or even the agnostic? It seems, and I remember in Holy Envy, you phrase it in a way that said we shouldn't castigate agnostics, or we should look again at that word. Mm-hmm. Did you find over the years that you were finding those students more and more putting themselves with those labels? And if so, did you find yourself having more of an affinity with them?
The labels are interesting, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Because, see, like nuns, N-O-N-E-S, I think is a miserable term, you know, for anybody, just because they put nun by affiliation. But if anything, I found students wanting to be sure I knew they were atheists. They didn't use agnostic or spiritual, but not religious as much. And so what I made of that is they wanted to be clear what they were against, what they were not, what they had left. And they hadn't found a term really that described what they were for or what they were seeking. The closest I came, and this was very rare, was to find someone who was a self-described humanist or existentialist. Or maybe seeker, but mostly it was students want to be very clear if they were atheists that I and everyone else knew that. So that's interesting, isn't it?
Why do you think that is?
Again, I think it was a clear, I am not that. And if world religions is at all about getting me to buy religion, I want you to know right now, I'm in here to get my credit for graduation, something like that. It had an edge to it, but you know, that's part of what college is about.
Sure.
Is having what Phyllis Tickle called the rummage sale. You know, what will I take of value from my upbringing and what will I put on the lawn now? So that was a gorgeous part of what they were up to, even when it was prickly.
It's a time of defining yourself. And so some students are clearly wanting to let you know this is one way that at least at this part of my life, I'm defining myself in this way.
Yeah. And see, I'm wanting to return questions to you about your community, but because I imagine you've got people who choose different ways to identify in your community.
Yeah. And we find people too. What's been interesting is for folks, especially in their 20s, some of whom want to claim what they grew up with. And so, for example, we've been receiving a lot of folks, LGBTQ folks who grew up in a more conservative background. But there's a part of them that still wants to claim part of that, that they have a robust belief in what Jesus can do in their life. And so I found that really interesting, that they don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, that there's a part of them that still want to claim part of that tradition too.
Right. And I have been, this is not from the classroom, but from some conferences I've been to, where it's wonderful to hear all this really edgy stuff from the stage. And then we all sing, you know, at the foot of the cross hymns and wave our arms in the air. So it's been wonderful to combine the, you know, parts of the hymnody, you know, sure, with some really different things coming over the microphone. And that's been a great kind of what, hybrid, maybe a hybrid or a whole new variety.
Yeah. Well, of course, because this podcast is about failure, I have to talk about the chapter in your book called Failing Christianity. It starts off, I loved the phrase from one of your students after you gave the quiz on Christianity, and one of your students said, I think I just did the worst on my own religion. And I think there are probably a fair number of Christians who relate to that. And so I'd love to talk to other readers who, when they begin to engage that chapter, is this about how I fail being a Christian? But at the end, I think you bring it more into focus. And so I'm going to quote another couple sentences from that chapter when you wrote, our mainline Christian lives are not particularly compelling these days. There is nothing about us that makes people want to know where we are getting our water. Our rose has lost its fragrance. The students in my class may be failing Christianity, but Christianity is failing them too. Mm-hmm. What kind of responses have you gotten from that chapter in particular? And do people agree with you?
I've gotten wonderful response. I mean, the whole book, authors never know what book they're writing until their readers tell them. And by then it's too late because it's out in print. But the two dominant responses to that chapter, A, please send us your Christianity quiz so we can see if we can pass it. People are very relieved when they get a B at least. So I've gotten that a lot. And then the other one, and it's really the sweetest comment I got from two Christian pastors was, you know, you told us about, you know, Christer Stendahl's second rule of religious understanding, which is don't compare your best to their worst. And they said, but we kind of feel like you compared our worst to everybody else's best. Mm. And I thought that was a dear comment in a way. You know, my response is usually my religion is the only one I can criticize. I mean, I'd be rude to criticize anybody others. But yeah, but I do think they had a point that there is in that I have more lament, right, about my own tradition. I have lament about people it has excluded and worse than that harmed and spiritually abused. And so I think it is probably a fair charge that in the book I'm harder on my own tradition than I am on any other. But most people who respond to failing Christianity just found it true that they had, they would score very high devotionally, but they didn't know much historically or literarily or even theologically about the faith. And in a classroom, that's more of what you're not going to get devotion unless you're perhaps at a Bible college. But, you know, in a college classroom, you're going to get more of how the religion looks to people outside of it. And I think that was the surprise to students who had looked only from the inside out and never from the outside in. Does that make any sense?
It does. Yeah. And what I appreciate too, I appreciate the word compelling, because with all the hand-wringing about the decline of the mainline, I have not heard that word used at a lot. This sense of, is what we are offering or doing our best to live out, does it make it compelling for somebody else to at least ask a question about it? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's pretty true. So I'm wondering about that word choice and in the way that you phrase that, is that kind of the response you wanted?
It is. As you can tell from that chapter and others, I mean, I have thought a lot about the hand-wringing. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when I go into churches, I feel like I'm going into a hospice facility because there's so much mourning around death and dying of the way things used to be. And that can really take our attention off what compels us to continue or what we hope might compel other people. It happened to me at a hotel in Atlanta recently. I mean, the concierge there was the most amazing man. I mean, he remembered names. He greeted people at the door. And I finally said, what is it about you? And he said, it's Jesus. And he witnessed to me right there in the lobby. It was lovely. But there was something about him that said, this guy is running on some kind of fuel. And I would love to know why he lives his life this way. So I'm not saying, you know, I want to be him, but wow, would I ever love, you know, for anyone to say, what makes you tick?
Mm.
And then when I have a decent answer.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Listeners, have a decent answer.
Well, what made you, when you talk about going into churches, some of them feel like hospices, this is actually maybe a little bit of a segue into, I also wanted to talk about your one of your other books, Leaving Church. Mm-hmm. And I was in a church a couple of years ago, at a, not a church I was a part of, but I was it was communion. And everyone walking up, just it looked like they were at a funeral. Mm. And they, there was just zero joy in partaking in that sacrament. And in from Leaving Church, it sounds like, at least when you wrote it, one of the things you missed the most, if not the most, was being the officiant in that sacrament yourself. And so I guess I just I bring that around to say, yes, it saddens me when I'm in those spaces, especially when something as beautiful as communion is going on and people are coming up with hangdog looks on their faces.
It's true. Yeah. One of my great laments about being the age I am is I'm just not going to see how this looks in 50 years or 100 years, but I have great hope. You know, I am sad about the pensions and the lost retirement funds and the buildings for sale, although some of them are being resold for quite wonderful community purposes, but I'm not sad about the possibility of new forms, you know, new life. The Jesus I knew looking one way, you know, appearing in a whole different way. And that goes for, you know, the Christ body in the world as well. I don't know how many of your listeners are comfortable with this kind of language, but I assume that they're fine with
it. Yes.
I went to one conference and said, now don't say God, because that's a trigger word for some people. I said, really? I can't say God. That's going to be tough.
Wow. I've not heard that one before. Well, I want to, in talking about Leaving Church, I want to talk about, again, this is the theme of the podcast, but about failure. And you used a phrase that I loved, and it was the phrase, you talked about the sin of omnicompetence. And as I was rereading Leaving Church, it struck me that, and I don't know if you would think it this way, it was almost, I was thinking to myself, she almost feels like she was a failure at being a success. at the things were going so well at your church, and you were, at least at that time, it was hard for you to really come to grips with that. And so can you say a little bit more about that phrase, the sin of omnicompetence?
Yeah. And you're very charitable to say at that time, because I did write that book a long time ago, and I would write it perhaps a little differently now. Though again, it's a book that I've been surprised at how people have used it in a more positive way than I would ever imagine. So to get back to your question, I experienced that especially coming to a small church where I was the only paid clergy person from a large multi-staff church in a downtown area. So the omnicompetence really hit me as solo pastor, where really everything, you know, was on my plate. As much as one delegates ministry and invites people to participate in ministry, when you're the paid person, you really are, you know, the person people count on to be sure the bulletin is proofread and that the yard guy is doing a good job, and on and on and on and on. So that, it did strike me when I was moving out of that office to go through the file cabinet and say, damn, this is a lot of stuff I tried to be good at, you know, better than good at. That's really a lot, you know, to be good at everything from community building to pastoral care to finance, to buildings, to personnel, you know, even in a small congregation. So that's what I meant by omnicompetence. And of course, you and I know a lot of our feelings of failure around that are in our own heads. You know,
right.
You go to the mirror and decide who you want to blame, and you look up and meet the eyes of the one person who is to blame about your sense of failure at the high expectations.
Did that, my from that book anyway, my sense that, which I think a lot of clergy do, they feel like, because they're generalists, and yet they still feel like, I've got to do everything just great. Did that carry over with you when you have been a teacher the last 20 years?
Gosh, that's a great question. It is an interesting thing. I speak only for myself to take God out of the equation. In other words, in the church, I represented the divine. In the classroom, I represented, I don't know, the registrar, you know, the person who was going to give out the degree at the end. So to take that out of the equation, in other words, not to take God or you know, faith or commitment out of myself, but to take it out of the contractual relationship between me and the people in front of me mm-hmm. was a huge relaxer, reliever. Mm. So I did have to work overtime, just learning new standards of grading and, you know, setting measurable objectives for classes. And I did try to become excellent in that, but I never got a teaching award. I was never even nominated for a teaching award. So it was a great thing to have the classroom be the place I shone. And there was no recognition particularly beyond.
Did that bother you?
You can hear there's a little sting in there, just a little sting. You know, yeah. Every year at convocation, you sit on the edge of your seat and say, this will be the year. But it never was the year. So, I was that's a very peculiar thing. I'm just going to process that off podcast, Christian. Yeah. I'm not going to process that. But it was a good, you know, when we get around to failure and failing boldly, that is always my kind of reliable spiritual practice, is to fail at something, or at least not to succeed in the way I had imagined. And it's exactly what I needed.
Yeah.
Exactly what I needed and what I never wanted.
When you look, and you mentioned, as we were talking about the fact that Leaving Church was written 15 or so years ago. Do you, as you look back at other things that you've written or maybe sermons that you've given, how much regret do you process or go through? Like, is there a book out there right now where you think, I so wish I could just kind of pull that back and rewrite some sections? Or have you been at peace with, well, that's who I was in that year?
Yeah, it is. I just read a manuscript by a young writer, and she put a great epilogue. She said, I'm 30. And she said, I just want everybody to realize I'm writing this book when I'm 30. And yeah. I may not think this 10 years from now. But so far, I think the only reason one can go on publishing is you have to let go of what you've written. I had a poet friend who said, a poem is never finished, only abandoned. And so there's a sense in which when you finish a book and it goes to print, that's that. With sermons, I've had recent reason to regret a lot of anti-Judaism, a lot of kind of automatic subconscious teaching about the Jews and the Pharisees and the burden of the law that has jumped out at me like crazy, you know, because I'm in a different place now. But I'm also glad I wrote those sermons when I did, because the longer I preach, the less and less I stand up and say boldly, you know, with no expectation of being questioned. That's pretty much gone. You know, it really... when I read old sermons now, I'm surprised at how much I thought I knew.
Yeah. So from the book, and I guess I should have looked this up, are you fully retired from Piedmont, or do you still go back? Or is this your last year? Or like, what are you doing these days other than writing and reflecting?
I'm supposed to be retired, but this is not the way it was supposed to feel. I was supposed to be gardening. I was supposed to be sitting on the front porch every night at sunset. So I've had I retired about 2 years ago and from full-time teaching, but I've kept up writing and speaking. So there's always plenty to do.
Yeah.
So
what are your daily practices then? Is it gardening when you're able and sitting on your porch? Are there other daily practices that, that you hold on to now that you've held on to for years, and some new ones too?
You know, yes. Though I must say I am most impacted and always have been by Christian classics, like, you know, the practice of the daily presence of God or everyday sacraments, or, you know, Brother Lawrence, who picked up a straw from the kitchen floor for the love of God and made pancakes for the love of God. So the great challenge for me has been to see how awake I can stay from morning to evening with what's right in front of me that's being given to me for my wholeness, for my healing. And that can quickly deteriorate into doing nothing. But I do think that reading and writing are my primary spiritual practices, because I can't get through a sentence without diving way down deep into how I think readers will read this, or other people I've known and what they might say about this. So all alone in a room, I'm in community not only with what feels like a very lively Holy Spirit and a very strong voice of judgment, but also everybody I've ever known and loved who are talking to me while I'm reading and writing. So that would be primary. And then right behind that would be maintaining a house and a farm with animals who force me to recognize that it's cold, or it's raining, or it's thundering, or I'm out of hay, or the water is broken, and those kinds of immediate calls to focus on what's right in front of me are actually a good counterpoint, aren't they, to the reading and writing, that kind of solitary way in your head, and then whoops, it's dinner time.
I would imagine that can be a little bit humbling too, especially maybe if you've gone to a very successful book signing, or you've gone and spoken somewhere and you get a standing ovation, but you've got to come home and then the animals don't care about that. They need to be fed. So I'd imagine that could also be a humbling practice too.
Yeah. Yeah. When I got some award for preaching, my husband said, "Oh, calm down. It's like being named badminton champion of the world." I've never forgotten that. In other words, it's a wonderful thing to go back and forth. My dad was a psychotherapist, and oh mercy, you know, in his treatment room, he was the boss of everything. And then he would come home and you know, the kids would just fight with him. And I watched that work well for him. So I think that's a great balance for anybody. Take both of those lives very seriously, is telling you who you are.
Well, I reached out to a couple of friends who are big fans of yours to ask, what would you ask Barbara Brown Taylor? And one question came back that I thought was really interesting. She asked, if you were to give a TED talk about anything other than religion or spirituality, the faith life, what would your TED talk be about?
Oh, gosh. See, no, I'm not going to answer that question. It's too good. about an hour. It would have probably chickens. I would probably talk, I would probably have kind of the Tao of chickens.
Nice.
Yeah, because I do have a bunch of them here, and I have learned as much about life, death, and the whatever from chickens as anything. So, and I would never be invited to do a TED talk on chickens, so I think we're safe here.
That's a good one. Well, I always end these conversations by asking guests to share a failure story of their own, and so I'd be curious if you wouldn't mind doing that now.
You know, I think because leaving church has put my major failure story in print. In other words, I thought I would be a parish minister forever, and I wasn't. But I went back to I was in my 30s, late 20s, when I experienced a call to ministry. And because I'm an Episcopalian, went through a one-year diocesan process. I mean, I jumped through so many hoops of different sizes. And at the end of that, I was told, no. And it was a remarkable thing. It was, you know, one of those fraught days where the whole group is sitting around in a circle and the supervisor is speaking to us one by one, saying whether we have a green light, a red light, or a yellow. And I got a yellow. I got another year of another kind of training to do. And I was furious about that for a long, long time. And it ended up slowing down an arrogance I had, you know, about it in, about my right to be given a green light. It changed my idea of who I was in that community. It took me down what ended up being a dead end road vocationally, raising money, becoming a fundraiser. But that failure stopped me in my tracks for a good couple of years and ended up being the best rest stop ever. And what I decided I wanted to say to you is, when I think of the failures in my life, it's the ones that I did not recover from quickly that did me the most good. The ones I recovered from quickly hardly count. They're just stick figures. But the ones that really set me back and really called for some reevaluation, rethinking, reforming were the best ones. So I hate that.
Are you able, with those failures that make you to slow down and really think, are you able in the moment say to yourself, okay, this is one of those things where I know I'm really supposed to slow down and take this in? Or is there that flash of like, so for example, when you're given the yellow light, was there a flash of like, screw them, I am not coming back to this?
It wasn't even a flash, Christian. It was much longer than that. Yeah, anger is my first response. And then usually a little bit of retrospective. But I'll tell you what, that is one good thing about having some decades, is I am beginning to see it a tiny bit ahead and say, whoa, 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 here, recognize this? Oh, I think I do. So that helps a lot now to see one coming. And I have preaching failures a lot, or speaking failures a lot, in my mind anyhow. And when I see one coming, I know it's almost funny. I say, oh, I'm about to give someone a great opportunity to critique me out in the parking lot and really to do better than I just did. And they're going to feel wonderful about that. And, you know, it's beginning to seem like a gift sometimes to fail, especially when you've been touched as being really good at something, to go ahead and fail. So that, I don't know, welcome to the human family, right?
Yeah.
When that happens. So.
Well, that gives us all, I noticed when I turned 50, there was almost like a magical wisdom that began to kick in. And that's one of the beauties of aging, is that you're able to take some of these things, and at least sometimes, not always, not take them quite so seriously, and be able to pause a little bit and say, I think actually I can learn a little bit from this anyway.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. That's part of the last third of life. I'm learning to call it the last trimester of life here. And, and I'm keeping my eye on the gold, and what you just said is part of the gold.
Yeah. Well, Barbara Brown Taylor's latest book is Holy Envy, Finding God in the Faith of Others. And it's certainly a well worth to buy it and to read it, as well as so many of her others too. And so, Barbara Brown Taylor, thank you so much for being part of this podcast.
I've loved the conversation. Thank you, Christian.
And that's this week's episode. Thanks again to Barbara Brown Taylor for giving her time for this conversation. To learn more about her and her books, you can go to her website, barbarabrowntaylor.com, or her Facebook page. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to christiankuhn.com. Please consider subscribing to this podcast, as my next conversation is with Keelan Blackwell, founder of the Chicago Eco House, a nonprofit that uses sustainability to alleviate poverty. Thanks again for listening.